The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks, the world's first global fintech podcast. This week, we're here at Sibos, the huge banking conference that's been put on by SWIFT since 1978. This year, 8,000 bankers from all over the world have come to Geneva, Switzerland to see hundreds of exhibitors and hear hundreds of speakers. The exhibit hall is massive. Over 1 million square feet of conference space and the exhibitor stands, well, stands isn't really the right word to describe them. These are high-tech exhibit spaces with huge video displays, like you would expect to see at the Consumer Electronics Show, complete with meeting rooms to cut important business deals, and some even have their own bars built in. It takes a lot of coffee to keep everyone going all day, and the team from InnoTribe, SWIFT's innovation arm, brought in Jimmy Monkey Coffee, a longtime favorite at Next Money conferences, all the way from Singapore. Jimmy Monkey's founder, Michael Ryan.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting and exciting setup that we have here. It's quite exciting to be back again. Thank you. It's 330 kilograms of coffee, 1,500 liters of milk, a ton of equipment, all chucked in a plane and sent over to Switzerland here, and 10 crew, all feverishly working away and putting out close to, I think we'll get close to 10,000 cups this year, and that's a lot of coffee.
There are a lot of familiar faces and voices here at Sibos. Here's Breaking Bank's own Liz Lumley, who spoke on a diversity panel.
So I spoke about the diversity and inclusion panel. And so we had Barclays, Lloyds, Bank of America, and UBS. They all told personal stories about how, you know, it's impacted them and how, you know, in their teams and why you need different voices. They talked a lot about talent acquisition, you know, and attracting talent for banks is a big issue. And they need that pool to be open to get the best quality people. And when diversity doesn't happen, you're looking at a pool of people that isn't going to be the best quality. Diversity is not lowering the bar, it's raising the bar. Diversity gets you Hamilton the musical, and six white guys in a room gets you Batman versus Superman.
Fair warning, conference organizers, when you invite Liz Lumley to your program, she always brings her journalist instincts.
Okay, yeah, so this was the plenary session for the InnoTribe Future of Money. Now, you know, I'm a former journalist, and I think everyone should be questioned. If we're having a discussion about what is the future of money, we need to see that future might not include banks, that future might not include some of the startups that are around right now, that future might be completely different than we're at now. So there were two people on stage, one from MasterCard and one from Betterment. And I just thought, you know, Betterment is a robo-advisor in the U.S., and there's a lot of robo-advisors about. But I think that there are questions around their business model. Like, how do you, the fees they charge are not going to cover the onboarding the client and keeping them for 3 years. The business model is not working out. This is not me saying I think robo-advisors are crap. The moderator just went, oh, that's really interesting and insightful. I'm like, no, well, ask, how are you going to survive in 3 years? Ask that question.
On last week's show, Brett and his guests talked quite a bit about real-time payments, and I had the chance to continue the conversation as I sat down with Gene Nayer, Head of Global Payments and Product Management at D&H. Gene has worked with banks and governments around the world to speed up payments, and he's a member of the Fed's Faster Payments Task Force. The pace can be furious at Sibos, but Gene took some time over a cup of tea to talk about what's happening in the world of global payments. Well, we talked last week on the show a bit about immediate payments, and it's certainly a future that's long incoming and long overdue. Tell us about where you are with that. Where have you had successes so far, and what is next coming up for the projects that you're working on?
In fact, there is a little bit of a discussion about what immediate payments really means. You can go as far back as late 70s with Japanese Zengen, or even to 1987, where Switzerland has implemented what they at the time called real-time payments. We feel that the current modern real-time payments begin in around UK, where many of the key elements of what we now consider to be a real-time payment scheme came together. One is reliance on ISO 20022, which is the new emerging or emerged lingua franca for banks. The other is the SLAs, which is 24/7 availability, typically 15 seconds to clear, and slightly looser, but still a very short time to make funds available. So, for example, in UK, at the time, it was 20 minutes from the time the transaction gets completed to the time that you can actually withdraw the funds and make use of them. Since then, if we count, we actually at this point have somewhere around 40 countries that either have implemented or are in the process of implementing real-time payments. So if you look at, there are around 200 countries in the world. We are now in wave two. So up to now, we had smaller countries, more homogeneous. If you look at countries like UK, with less than 1,000 banks. You look at countries like Sweden with a population of about 8 million. Those were sort of the easy first steps. We are now coming into a certain level of experimentation. We are coming into what would be phase two real-time payment in US, Europe with multiple countries and around about 10,000 banks. So those are now going to be massive, massive projects. And of course, it continues with Latin America, Asia, Canada, all thinking about creating real-time payments.
So where have you had the most success so far?
We have started in UK. We're very fortunate to have the leading, most innovative immediate payments, or the, as they call it in UK, faster payments bank, Barclays. On a peak day, we process almost 4 million transactions a day. We're particularly proud of that geography because they were able to grow immediate payments from 1% of non-cash payments to 10% of non-cash payments over the period of 8 years. So now UK is processing around about 1.2 billion transactions a year. We are very proud of our Swedish implementation. Swish, which is the mobile payment platform that uses payments in real time as a rail, is the second most downloaded financial application in Sweden. The first one being, how do I find Swish? And it really had a transformative effect on Sweden, even to the point of shifting the crime from being robbery, where you actually get held up at knife point for money, to now forcing people to swish money to your account. And so we had our first electronic robbery, and somebody forced somebody to swish 100 kroner to his account, which is on one end silly because you know who the person is because you know their account. But on the other hand, it had to go to court, and the complainant lost. He could not prove that that he didn't owe the guy 100 kroner for the beer.
That's innovation in cybercrime. Even faster payments has a dark side. I asked Gene what's happening in the rest of the world for faster payments.
So tell us what's happening in some of the other countries.
Australia is really interesting for two reasons. Up to now, all of the real-time implementations were centralized in the clearinghouse. Australia is the first one that is adapted the decentralized model. What enables that is the fact that Australian Reserve Bank is offering real-time 24/7 clearing. The other interesting thing in Australia, unlike previous real-time schemes, there is no scheme limit. It is entirely up to the bank to decide, based on the risk profiles of their customers, how innovation is going to be enabled by this scheme, because Australia is taking a very architecturally sound approach of developing basic infrastructure and then delivering overlay services, as they call them, on top of it. And that is intended to really do two things. One is to spur innovation, and the other is to tie real-time payments tightly into the fabric of the new emerging digital economy. U.S. has adapted a centralized clearinghouse model and is using some of the proven techniques to get to market faster. So even though U.S. started, I would say, almost a year after Australia, they are intending to deliver their solution about a quarter ahead of Australians. So that is proving what you can do with taking proven technology. Other interesting thing about U.S. is obviously the scale, the number of institutions, the number of players. In U.S., Fed has decided not to take the operator role, as has been its traditional purview in the past, but is in fact acting as a facilitator to enable multiple real-time rails to flourish. And as part of that, I'm a member of Fed Faster Task Force. We are all focused on making sure that any rail that's introduced is not proprietary, is open, it's ubiquitous.
So briefly, what are the pros and cons of a centralized versus a decentralized approach to faster payments?
So what is proven in the market is centralized schemes. We know that with a really good telecommunication infrastructure, we can get transactions from banks to the central point in milliseconds, regardless of how vast your country is. Even in U.S., in high-frequency trading, we get New York to Chicago in less than 100 milliseconds. So that works and works well. What it does introduce is a single point, and so you need to invest in disaster recovery, and you have to make sure that it is protected. However, I think that's not a very strong negative, because that is what clearinghouses and central banks have been doing for the last 100 years, and I think by now we have gotten it right. Now, decentralized is an interesting idea, goes a little bit along the lines of coin architectures, where the processing happens at the edges of the network, and you don't have a central processing authority, you just have centralized governance. We will have to see how the Australian experiment works out to see if pushing the processing to the bank really results in very large savings to the community. I have to say that based on the initial price tag that Australia is paying, they haven't budgeted in those savings. I would also say that in U.S. we started with the check clearing in a decentralized model and then decided that we would want to move to centralized because it turned out to be more efficient. So stay tuned.
Gene Nayer from D&H. We'll be right back from the Cybos conference in Geneva after this short break. But first, I want to thank our sponsor, Temenos. For more on how they're driving innovation in banking, go to temenos.com.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks. If you've ever listened to my podcast and enjoyed it, you'll know I focus a lot on the future. When you look at artificial intelligence, robotics, self-driving cars, smart infrastructure, smart cities, health tech, gene editing, computers everywhere that are smart, this is going to have major impact in the way we live our life and the way society interacts. That's the subject of my new book, Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out in the first week of May. Ramez Nam, the Philip K. Dick Award-winning author of Nexus, said, "You need to read this awesome roadmap of the future that Brett King has created." Please go and check out Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, available on Amazon for order today.
Always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks, the world's first global fintech podcast. I'm JP Nichols, and this week we're at the Sibos conference in Geneva. Despite the growth and prominence of fintech and the rise of InnoTribe at Sibos, this is still primarily a banking conference. And despite the need for diversity that Liz Lumley talked about, that means a lot of men in suits. So it was easy to spot a more casually dressed Markus Gnirk, his German accent perhaps fitting in a little less conspicuously here than in his adopted home of Singapore. Markus built the Startup Bootcamp FinTech Accelerator there, and now he's a FinTech investor in his new firm, Tribe. I asked him what caught his interest so far.
Well, I've been here now for just 2 days. I have seen InnoTribe faces, I've seen the family coming back together from the fintech world, from Europe mainly. It's been good to see what's going on here. I've been visiting a lot of startups, mentoring the startups from different accelerators and having office hours there, which is very good. Haven't really joined many sessions yet, as I have not really found anything that is new or really, you know, I think cutting edge in the conversation that is going on in the fintech world. So I'm hoping the next 2 days are going to be a bit more insightful on new trends in fintech that are going beyond the traditional stuff that is, I think, already out there on social media and in the groups. So yeah, it's going to be good.
Well, we won't see a lot of those on the main stage. Those will be coming from the startups anyway.
That's I'd be probably way right there. Yes, I agree.
Great. Thanks, Markus.
Sure.
I ducked out of the busy exhibit hall to find an unused conference room for a quiet conversation with Eric Vanderclay. Eric was formerly head of Level 39 in London, Europe's largest fintech accelerator. Now he's special advisor to Kickstart Accelerator in Zurich, where they're working on bringing more corporate sponsors in to support and drive innovation in not only fintech, but also future and emerging technologies, smart and connected machines on the Internet of Things, and food tech. Eric, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you very much, JP.
Welcome back. I think you've been on the show before, right?
No, I haven't, but I'm one of your biggest fans.
Oh, well, I'm glad I get to be the first one then to interview you. So, Eric, we met. You were a founder of Level 39, a epicenter, arguably, of the fintech ecosystem in London. And now you're off to Zurich with the Kickstart Accelerator. Tell us about what's happening there and how that all came about.
Well, that's very kind of you to call Level 39 the epicenter. I'd like to say it's one of the epicenters of fintech. But yes, so since handing over the reins to Ben Braben, by the way, you should bring him on as well because he's awesome. I've moved across and am now a special advisor to the Kickstart Accelerator in Zurich. Kickstart Accelerator is more than fintech. It's actually four themes, including food tech, advanced machines, IoT, but fintech obviously plays a huge part of it. So Kickstart is an initiative of Digital Switzerland. It's about transforming the traditional economies of Switzerland. And Kickstart is one of the biggest initiatives. And we are loving it. We've taken a former electricity generating substation and in 4 weeks transformed it into the most amazing hub for startups. And we've had 850 plus applications for the Kickstart Accelerator. And we have 30 finalists with us on this 11-week accelerator program, intense curriculum. And we've brought a lot of the cohort here to Sibos.
So this is the first cohort?
This is the first cohort, yes. Obviously, it's being set up and designed to continue year after year. And my team is here, and we're here as special advisors to bring, you know, the experience that we've had in London to help here. But here is very special because here we've got so many corporates engaged. It's quite amazing. Corporates that traditionally competed. So we really are seeing co-opetition being practiced to the finest art here in Switzerland.
So how are you able to bring that about, changing that competition to co-opetition, or even in some cases cooperation, to really agree on some of the same standards and some of the same approaches so that you can get economy of scale across multiple startups looking at different solutions?
So you know, JP, how hard it is to get you know, corporates to agree on different, you know, strategic directions. So I have to say that I'd love to take the credit for this, but actually it is the genuine initiative of those corporates that sponsored and are funding this Digital Switzerland initiative. where not only are they collaborating over things like the POCs, but they're actually freely contributing towards a genuine transforming of their economy. And that's why they're doing it. They really want to make a difference here. When they said to me, Eric, you should tender, this is an important accelerator, I looked at the number of potential partners they were, and I thought, well, you know, that's a master work in multi-stakeholder management, and that's a difficult thing to do. But I have to say that the way it's structured has been terrific, because we have full-time executives from the corporates assigned to help us smooth the transition for those really important POCs.
So POCs, proofs of concept. Do they come prepared with their own, or have they developed new ones or perhaps changed ones that they had in mind once they got together with the rest of the consortium?
So the corporates are obviously have their focus areas, and that helps inform the decision making in the cut from 850 down to 30. I wouldn't say that that's the only factor. We use a lot of external judging to help with that as well, but it definitely informs and it means that the startups are relevant. But then within the individual corporates, looking for innovation, whatever their strategies are, they find that the startups help shape their propositions together with the corporates over the 11 weeks, so that when it's demo day, the propositions are so correct and so appropriate for creating either partnerships or a supplier relationship that it becomes the real reason this is going to be, we hope, one of the most successful accelerators of its kind. It will just be very appropriate because of the deep involvement of the corporates. This isn't a demo day, everybody's a show and tell and then goes home. The demo day to us is the beginning of the deeper relationship and the way that the Swiss economy and Swiss financial services economy becomes much more porous to innovation.
So do you think this corporate approach is something relatively unique in this case and something that was lacking in the ecosystem prior to Kickstart Accelerator?
So most of the companies that we're engaging with already have a strong innovation capacity, and they have various programs. Some of them even have very strong venture capital, corporate venture capital capacity. What this is an increasing of that and an acknowledgement of the incredible importance that innovation plays. Even here at Sibos, where we're sitting, you're seeing things like InnoTribe, now not really a sideshow. This is dead square in the middle of the most important, if you like, exhibition that exists, I think, in this industry. So innovation is the way that these companies are going to survive and thrive, but it's also a terrific deal for the startups because it gives them access and visibility to the kind of people that will give them the scale that they're seeking.
So the startups that you have involved, are they from Switzerland or from all over?
No, we have over 20 countries. We have startups from Rwanda, from China. It's absolutely terrific having them all in the same hub. And I think that's one of the enriching features of an accelerator, is that blending of cultures, because it's actually the intersection of cultures and ideas that real innovation and spark takes place. So we're encouraging the startups from all over the world to collaborate and to explore collaborating. And you are seeing some really interesting things emerge.
Will you also see cross-pollination across the tracks, say IoT and fintech or even food tech?
Exactly. In fact, here within the cohort, we do have companies that have come to Sibos that were not originally part of the fintech strategy. But when you think about some of the other sponsors, you've got partners such as Migros and Co-op. And they, of course, have amazing reach into the consumer and supermarkets right across Switzerland. So they, too, are innovators, and they are seeing both financial services-related innovations, as well as innovations such as provenance of food, extraordinary innovations. And Kickstart isn't, as I say, just one. It's not just fintech, but it's reaching across these four main themes to help create, if you like, a center of excellence within Switzerland.
Well, certainly Switzerland's a center of excellence for food and in the middle of a lot of other centers of excellence here in Europe. What exactly is food tech and where is that going from here? That seems decidedly low tech.
Oh, it's extraordinary. Well, when you think about that, I mean, I'll just try and pick out a couple of examples for you. We have a company from the Philippines who have one of the boldest challenges they're trying to solve, right? Apparently, 1/3 of the world's food production goes to waste. And what they do is they take this food, this organic waste, and they convert it into food powder, which can be used in all sorts of food production. What an amazing goal, right? What do you want to do? I want to solve 1/3 of the world's food production, which goes to waste. That's kind of cool. The other ones, we have amazing company that's growing protein, that has like a protein factory. So, you know, their presentation was a real, you know, I feel like a bit of a Luddite here, because it was an eye-opener for me, because they showed me how much water and methane is produced and consumed in producing 1 kilogram of beef. They can produce the same amount of protein for something like 1% of the water with zero methane. Those are the kind of innovations that are quite extraordinary. So we're very excited to see them as part of the Kickstart Accelerator.
So do you think there'll be other tracks that expand in Kickstart Accelerator beyond the existing four?
I think so, and I'd like to see that happen, because Switzerland has other industries that it's very well known for that certainly could contribute well towards and be part of this innovation transformation. And, you know, there's another aspect to this, which is the UK also has some strong industries, and I think that there's probably never been a better time for countries like Switzerland and the UK to collaborate over things like innovation. I think we have a growing number of similarities between us.
Despite Brexit.
Well, I think because of Brexit, possibly.
So what else do you want to tell us about the Kickstart Accelerator that I haven't asked you?
Well, I think just focus on what the differentiators are. So obviously it is one of the biggest accelerator programs in Europe that's multi-sector and zero equity. So even though there are cash prizes, we take no equity, which is, I think, incredibly important. The other aspect is the commitment of the corporates. When you think about what the corporates are doing here, they're committing their time and the resources, and my team is working with them almost every day to make sure that when the demo day takes place, these the examples of the POCs can take place. So all the problems are solved. If anybody's been in innovation, know how hard that is to do, right? Like, where's the data set? What are the services sit on? Who's the head of the department? What's the procurement process? Whose insurance is going to pay for this? And, you know, what are the key milestones? All of those things we're dealing with now so that it can become one of the most effective, we hope, accelerators, an example of how to do this in the future.
So you're telling me that those kinds of corporate challenges and barriers to innovation do not exist just in financial services?
What is it somebody said? There are antibodies in corporates everywhere. But actually, there is a genuine willingness here to transform that and transform those antibodies into catalysts to help the innovators access the scale that corporates can give them.
What have you seen here at Cybos or at the InnoTribe stand that you've liked so far?
Well, I have to say that I am blown away by the InnoTribe stand. For those of you that have been here this year, it is, to me, one of the most terrific examples of the importance of innovation, receiving what I think is the appropriate showcase. So, chapeau to all those involved in putting it together, because it is pretty special. And what's also nice is that they're showcasing different ecosystems from around the world, different fintech hubs from around the world. So that's also incredibly important. I mean, we have startups here from China that want to know how to access the European market. And so having things available, and for example, InnoTribe collaborating with Kickstart to run office hours here is an important step for both of us, because it brings all of these amazing experts from that come to Cybos and makes them accessible to the startups. That's one of my big takeaways this year. I think this is more fintech this year than I've ever seen Cybos.
Okay, Eric Vander Clay, how do people find out more about you or the Kickstart Accelerator?
Well, you can Google Kickstart Accelerator on the web, or you can contact us directly through the Kickstart team who are based here at Cybos.
Thanks for being here with us.
Thank you.
The always colorful Dwayna Blomstrom stopped by. She's a well-known fixture at many fintech conferences, but this was her first Cybos.
Yes, it is. It's my first one. I'm a Cybos virgin. Hopefully that's all right on the air. But I found it really interesting. I had heard a lot about it over the years. I had seen, I have spent many sleepless nights watching the Twitter feed on the conversations. I was slightly excited and slightly disappointed in equal measures. I found that people, for instance, book loads and loads of meetings. I'm not positively sure why. Same phenomenon as with Money 2020, I suppose it would be much easier to find these people in your local town than it is to book it somewhere far away. Instead of that, you have rooms where you have incredibly astute speakers that aren't as filled as they necessarily should be. I find that the content of the conference is incredibly superior to some other places I've seen, in the sense that it's been really well rehearsed. People know their subject matter. They're normally captains of the industry. And of course, you have really fun things such as InnoTribe. And I think one thing that people don't realize is not only is there loads of innovation and vibe around the InnoTribe bits, but also if you walk around the stands of the banks, there might not be a lot of news, but there are a lot of fun little tidbits and perks that will engage you in a conversation. So I would say that people should take note of what those are and kind of stop and look at the little cows and get the massage and have a conversation going.
Was there anything in particular that caught your eye?
I thought that there's a lot of regional conversation, if you wish, in Europe, in the sense that you're going to find Switzerland only places of nucleuses of fintech innovation. You're going to find Germany ones. There's a lot of French companies that are kind of congregating around each other. I found it interesting that they would be country segregated and not necessarily European. At the same time, on the other side, because this is in Europe and we get to kind of be more granular this year, you have really big African and Asian contingents on the other side, which are not as granular as we are in Europe. What I did find is there are some countries in Europe that are still stepping up, and they feel like they are now creating, reinventing the innovation and incubation wheel, which is interesting. I wonder how much more we all collectively have in our bag of tricks in terms of coming up with new things in Europe. But undoubtedly, the ecosystem of making incubators, innovation, and accelerators happen is well thriving in these places.
Great. Anything else you want to tell us I haven't asked you?
Oh, so many things. I don't believe we have that kind of time. But no, I think things are finally moving slower than we all would like them to see moving. But the vibe in Cybos is absolutely excellent, so people should absolutely come see it.
Partnerships and cooperation have been recurring themes this year at Cybos, and Lawrence Wintermeyer is here for just that reason. He's the CEO of Innovate Finance, a London-based NGO that's bringing together a network of fintech hubs all over the world to improve the regulatory environment. His head of communications has been shuttling him between interviews in the busy press room.
So you have been busy working on a lot of things. Being based in London as you are, Brexit is a part of the latest topics that people are talking about. So what is your latest perspective on fintech and Brexit?
Well, as you know, Brexit was a pretty emotive topic in the city and in the fintech community on Friday, the 24th of June, a day after the vote. In our own community, more than 30% of our startup founders or CEOs are non-Brits, many of those Europeans. I've worked in financial services in London for 25 years, and we were integrated, in the European market, particularly the further you go back into cap markets. So I think we were all surprised, and not just in fintech in the city. I think there was a general level of surprise. All of these weeks later, JP, so how many weeks? So we're sort of, 12 plus weeks on. The sentiment from not just startups, but institutions is pretty extraordinary. Most people have just dusted themselves off, carried on with business. Most people in industry have recognized the sheer complexity of Brexit, not least of which is first the disengagement process, and that there are 27 other counterparties, including the European Union, that we need to disengage, who need to get some sort of parliamentary approval of a disengagement plan, followed then by a second step, which is a negotiation to trade with the European Union after exit. So it's just too complex for smart capital or business, and innovators are innovating.
And a lot of cities have been trying to establish themselves as fintech hubs too. I'm imagining that they're seeing Brexit as an opportunity to perhaps knock London down a peg or two, and some of those cities are here. I mean, what are you seeing from the other cities? And in many respects, you're embracing that and working with other hubs around the world.
Well, in partnership with Swift and the Innotribe team, and Peter Van at Innotribe with Misha Rao from my own team, were really instrumental in starting this last year, in getting the hubs together. You know, we started off more than a year ago saying it was all about the battle of the hubs, and I made one call before those and said, well, actually, it isn't really a battle. We collaborate more than anything. Sure, there's competition, as there is anywhere in the ecosystem. We've set up the hub, which really is a voluntary global network to bring together all of the hubs. So we've got 40 registered constituents, and out of those, there's approximately 29 or 30 of the hubs with 11 ecosystem partners. In Europe, we're supportive of all of the hubs, and I think post-Brexit, our own view is that we'll probably spend more time with Benelux, Germany, and Dublin, which are the big cluster hubs that our own membership are based around. But you know, as an independent non-for-profit, and again, with the strength of a partner like Innotribe, you know, we feel we're in a good leadership position to promote that.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the regulatory nature. There's been some people trying to take opportunity to kind of have regulatory arbitrage, right? Well, we will set up our fintech company in country X instead of country Y because we think the regulatory scheme is better or more favorable or whatever. You know, do you still see that happening? And do you see this as they come together? Will we get more uniform? Will we see more consistency across the countries in terms of the way they're regulating, particularly regulating fintech, which is still ahead of the regulators?
Well, I think those are excellent challenges you pose. Who knows? I'll give you a hypothesis, because in a world where we're seeing increased geopolitical risk, and we're seeing the volatility of that, not just in markets, but clearly in society, and we've got a U.S. election coming up, a French election, and a German election, I think practical issues may very well be driving sovereign regulatory agendas. I think the great benefit of digital and where we are with the supercomputer of a phone in your hand all connected to the internet with great apps is that digital is actually globally scalable, and the West Coast has done a great job of really proving that over the past 20 or 30 years and accumulating the capital and the wealth of making that successful. In financial services, most of the work you and I have seen in fintechs has broadly been in the unregulated or the peripherally regulated spaces, and now it's starting to get into the capital-intensive side of regulation. And so I think institutions and fintechs have found that they're better off to collaborate, in that regulation and broadly what you and I would call customer adoption or being successful with a product are the two biggest areas of sort of capital intensity, whether you're David or Goliath. So the incentives, I think, from industry to get the regulator to simplify and get right touch regulation are in place. I think with the FCA, and we always call it our biggest comparative advantage in the UK. If you look at the fintech ecosystem relative to New York, New York raises a bit more capital. We have a few more thousand fintech, fintech staff or talent. But it really is what the FCA is doing progressively in things like Project Innovate or the Regulatory Accelerator. You know, they appointed us to chair this global consultation on industry sandboxes so that we can get industry and regulatory sandboxes working together. And I think that's progressive. So if you look around the world, regulators that are connecting to the FCA, and the FCA and Treasury are doing a very good job of connecting to other regulators, recognize that digital and reg tech or some of these innovation tools that are being developed certainly offer an answer or a hypothesis to the question you're asking, which is there are more incentives to getting right size regulation and to getting regulatory interoperability in the systematic financial system than building walls. So I think that seems to be going well. And on your arbitrage point, two guys of the same sort of vintage in financial services, arbitrage, whether it's reg, currency, or labor, goes on within the legal framework of the world. So I think that long will it continue, regardless of what you and I think. In the context of Europe, though, and regulatory arbitrage, Again, the European system, particularly around MiFID or UCITS or around payments, and this is a revolving around the passporting scheme, I think has created a great blueprint for how many countries can actually adapt single standards and be able to work interoperably. So regardless of where the UK goes, I think we'll maintain the interoperability of those systems. And so I'll focus on a kind of a mega topic that you and I see coming up all the time, which is around open banking APIs. From our perspective, the open banking work in the UK is kicking off now. The nine banks are, in essence, appointing the governance model and getting ready to start that project. That is a preempt to the Payment Services Directive 2 here in Europe. And so I think, again, for the most part, it is broadly regulators, institutions, and entrepreneurs that are driving this agenda. And I think with anything, if we get enough momentum and force and enough collective responsibility for it, we'll end up in a system where we have a better global level playing field on a lot of these things.
EY have come out with a capital markets report on fintech, and you were involved with that. Talk a little bit about that and what you saw in that report.
Yes, it's a fantastic report in that it is a landscape or a baseline of what's going on in capital markets from a technology perspective and a directory of fintechs that are playing in each of those areas of the landscape. And it's an extraordinary example of the things that happen in the innovate finance community that I get impressed with. And we had an inaugural Cap Markets member working group, which has four chairs, two fintechs, two institutions, so it's Standard Charter, UBS, along with Origin and Profis, two startups. This was in January, and the two big discussion points were, how do we collaborate better, which is a big one for institutions and startups in the community. And the second one is, what's going on in this space? It's just so difficult. Nobody has visibility. And one of the co-chairs said, that WEF landscape report that was done, the World Economic Forum Future Financial Services, what was great for retail, we need something, for cap markets. David Williams, EY partner, and EY is a member, put up his hand and said, great, we'll undertake it. So EY interviewed virtually all of our members, or a large number of our members that are part of that working group, and constructed a report that focused on really the big technologies that are impacting capital markets, a nomenclature or a taxonomy of what those clusters look like, and an index really, or what we think is the first index or inventory of global capital markets, fintech plays. And, collaboration is really the number one item coming out of it, which from, I think, an investment bank or an asset management, so it doesn't matter whether you're buy or sell side, your return on investment numbers are in single figures, your cost income ratios are high. Technology really does offer one of the best opportunities, to help solve some of those things. And fintechs and collaborating with them, is certainly one of the most helpful ways that you can accelerate that. So, we're excited about the report, which is being launched today, and those findings.
So going back to the hubs, you were in New York. I saw you last around Finovate. You launched an initiative in North America a few weeks ago. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, again, we're really delighted about that. And that's predominantly driven by the member community and the ecosystem. And out of our, we've got just under 300 members, but broadly the ratio of institution to startup is 1-5. And out of all of our institutions, more than half of them are U.S. East Coast based. And so the appetite for the regulatory agenda and what's going on, not just in Project Innovate sandboxes. So we started in Washington in March with a transatlantic policy work group, which is just convening, again, our community, but with an invitation, an open invitation to regulators in the U.S. fintech ecosystem and, some of our partners like the accelerators of the VCs to bring their fintechs along to have constructive discussions on particularly how post-OCC submission in the U.S. We can use that community to start generating the white papers you need to do to start to activate areas of government. And so that's been pretty exciting for us. We're doing it in partnership with Hogan Lovells, who are a strategic law firm. And the big areas of focus, were particularly around reg tech and sandboxes, which are the two, you know, we'd call them fintech megatrends that we see going on globally. So we had great support from the FCA, and Anna Wallace kicked us off, along with Maria Gotch from the Partnership Fund of New York. We ran a number of sessions for the whole week with the membership, which, again, Anna Wallace from the FCA attended, which was just extraordinary. And again, it's a regulator that I think so plainly sets out the case of how and why the FCA is on the route that it is, but is open to discussing really with anyone anywhere in the world how it is they're approaching fintech innovation and digital. So again, I'm just so impressed with that, because the one thing that did come out of the U.S. When we were in Washington and at the White House earlier this year is this idea that in the U.S., particularly with 9 federal regulators and 50 state regulators, moving the dialogue from enforcement to engagement is a pretty important point. And so, you know, gee, anything we can do from a membership perspective to help that out is what we're on the ground for, first and foremost.
Well, I can tell you I appreciate your efforts.
Lawrence Wintermeyer from Innovate Finance. If you're interested in blockchain, go to mit.edu/blockchain. Submit your feedback on how blockchain should be legally defined. This is all going to be a part of a hearing that's going to take place in Washington, D.C. on October 12th or 13th. Chris Skinner will be doing a presentation of book signing on his latest book, Value Web, at Goodwin Law on October 4th at 8:30 a.m. in the New York Times building in New York. Our friends at Findevor are coming back to Silicon Valley on October 18th and 19th. It'll showcase the latest tools, platforms, and case studies for all the techies in fintech. Register now with the code BBANKSDEVR20 and get a 20% discount. Next Money returns to Hong Kong January 18th and 19th with FF17, the Fintech Finals. Register at fintechfinals.com and save 25% with code BB25. Don't forget to follow the show on Twitter, at BreakingBanks1. And follow me at JP Nichols, NICOLS. And follow the show on Facebook at Breaking Banks Radio. If you like the show, please go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps us a lot, and it helps people find the show. So that's it for this week's show. Thanks again to our sponsor, Temenos, and we'll be back next week with more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.
Hey guys, it's Brett King from Breaking Banks. If you've ever listened to my podcast and enjoyed it, you'll know I focus a lot on the future. When you look at artificial intelligence, robotics, self-driving cars, smart infrastructure, smart cities, health tech, gene editing, computers everywhere that are smart, this is going to have major impact in the way we live our life and the way society interacts. That's the subject of my new book, Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, which comes out in the first week of May. Ramez Nam, the Philip K. Dick Award-winning author of Nexus, said, "You need to read this awesome roadmap of the future that Brett King has created." Please go and check out Augmented, Life in the Smart Lane, available on Amazon for order today.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.